Hi, it's Craig Haskell with the Value Hound Academy. You're listening to another exclusive interview with a leading authority in the opportunistic and value real estate investing space. You're in for a real treat. We are speaking with David Campbell on how he transformed his life as a high school band teacher and became a successful real estate investor using creative deal making, buying distressed properties. David has been a principal or advisor on over $800 million of real estate since his days as a high school teacher. Because of David's success, he has been in high demand as a frequent guest speaker at numerous events, radio shows, and taught at leading universities. Believing that properties do not have problems, people do. David takes a people-first approach towards finding creative solutions to properties. David's unique gift is finding creative solutions to getting deals done, and in this interview, he shares some of his exclusive examples of his most creative deals. In this interview with David, you will learn how he started his business and what makes him different, the biggest challenges he had to overcome, things he's doing to make money in today's distressed real estate market, how David's making money using real estate exchanging and trading strategies. Lessons learned during his rapid path to success. If you're looking for new and creative ways to get deals done in today's distressed market, then you need to listen to this high-value interview with David Campbell. David will open your eyes to new opportunities to make money. All right, David, you've got a great story. You came from very, very humble beginnings as a high school band teacher. That's awesome. And today you've built this sizable international real estate investment company. Can you tell us how you got started and how you built your company?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I started out teaching high school band, and my first check was less than $30,000 a year. And living in Southern California, I figured out really quickly that was not going to be enough money to raise a family on. And so I started looking for what else was in the marketplace. How could I make some ancillary income? And fortunately, in college, I worked in a mortgage brokerage office and a tax office, and I had a good financial background. And I went out, and the first thing I did is I bought a two-bedroom, two-bath condo, and I lived in one half, and I rented out the other half. And lo and behold, the first year, equity happened to me, and the property went up more than what my salary was. And at the end of the first year, I said, look, I got no money in my checking account, but suddenly I have a $30,000 net worth because of real estate that would not have been there in any other way. And that got me the bug. So I took that first concept and learned how to equity optimize and pull the equity out of that property, and I bought another house, and that property did well for me, and I bought four more houses, and those did well, and I just doubled down and got eight more houses and then got into an apartment building, and then just really got the bug for real estate development, and I started a home building company and a commercial renovation company. So we buy distressed shopping centers and fix their problems, and then got the bug international. I looked at the Caribbean and Mexico and Canada as some pretty viable places to invest, and it was just something that grew organically from a humble start with no capital and really relying on my creativity and ingenuity and relationships to really kind of bootstrap my way into a pretty healthy real estate company.
Well, it sounds like you've kind of grown your company slow but sure, kind of like the turtle theory, one step forward, never taking many steps back. But as time went on, you've just gotten bigger and bigger.
Well, I like to say if you meet someone who's never lost money in real estate, they must not have been doing it very long. Because I would love to be the slow and steady turtle, but back in the early 2000s, the motto was real estate will always go up, it never goes down, and I sure was too young and naive to realize that is not true. And I got bit by a market cycle. And so my new philosophy is really very dependent on cash flow. I made my initial, first couple million dollars entirely on equity and forced equity plays. And, so who needs cash flow when your property goes up 30% a year? You can buy negative cash flow when the market's that hot. But what goes up, you know, goes down, and you learn a lot from that kind of market correction, and much, much smarter. You know, today it's all about cash flow. You know, what can we get that's producing positive cash flow? But that isn't really where the money is. It's really the cash flow controls the debt. And in an inflationary economy, as the currency devalues, so does your debt, and that's where the equity comes from. But the you know, this time around, I'm not waiting for the market to go up while being in negative cash flow. I want to be really highly leveraged with positive cash flow.
So you'd say one of your biggest challenges that you had to overcome as you were beginning was cash flow.
Yeah. Well, when I first started out, any kind of cash was a challenge. You know, I was able to get into my first property owner occupied, and back then they had 100% financing, and then that first property gave me my down payments, and then from then on I had a down payment machine. These days, you know, if you're getting started in real estate, you know, having that down payment is more important than ever. And where do you get it from? And, you know, in creative real estate, the easiest place to find the down payment is from the seller. You know, oftentimes the seller will either loan you or, you know, give you a piece of his equity in exchange for you solving his problem in some way.
Well, Dave, when you got going, obviously everybody's learning along the process. Did you have any models, role models, or people that helped you along the way?
Yeah, of course. You know, the no man is an island. Everybody's got to, you know, look for a team and surround themselves with really smart people. And what's one of the things that's really key to my hassle-free cash flow investing philosophy is the team comes first. And you build, get a bunch of smart people around you, and really kind of leverage on their strengths. And one of my, you know, sound bites is, in a partnership, if two people have the same skill set or the same resources, then one of those people is redundant. And so I always try to surround myself with people that are smarter than me, that have been more successful than me. And, you know, some of my key models at first were authors, you know, just going to the the bookstore, so to speak, and picking up books in the Robert Kiyosaki series. Those were really helpful to me. The Real Estate Guys radio program, that was a very successful part of my mentoring program. And local broker, you know, initially, you know, I bought a house, and I saw a house next door was for rent, and I thought, I wonder how much that house rents for. So I called the phone, and I pretended I was a tenant, and the broker knew pretty quickly. He's like, you're too smart to be a tenant. You must be a real estate investor. And I said, well, I would like to be a real estate investor. And he said, well, you'll come to my office, and I'll teach you a little bit about real estate investing. And that was kind of my first hands-on mentorship. And it was a broker named Larry Gage down in Southern California, and he was a really good mentor for me early on. I learned a lot, and then you know, moved on from that relationship to you know, finding mentors in the development space and getting mentors that have had a lot of success in development projects. And one of the great ways to get a mentor is to partner. You know, I've got interns that work for my company, and their primary motivation is so that they can learn, so they can be around my team and get mentorship from me and the people that are on my development projects. And it's a really good thing. Surround yourself with smart people. Find a way to add value first, and when you add the value, then your team will find a way to reward you as well.
Yeah, you got to have a small ego for that. It sounds like you do. That's awesome. Well, let's see here. Now, your company's really turning the corner, and it really started to take off. Were there one or two big things that really propelled your success?
Yeah, I would say the first thing is just looking to give first and realizing that the pie is big enough to share. And if you always ask the question, lead with the question, how can I add value to you? Either it's to a person, or how do I add value to the marketplace? Because, you know, in boom times, you know, the dumb people can make money just because the market's going crazy. But in lean times, like we're in now many, many times, you got to be really smart, and you have to have some loyal people around you. So the most important thing in my business is just to have integrity with the people who are on your team, add value to them first, and if they return value to you, then they're a keeper. You know, they're part of your team for life, and if you add value to them and they just take and don't return value, then you just say, well, you paid a little bit to learn that you just need to move on and find some new relationships. The second thing is really just keep your eyes open for opportunity and be, in many cases, have a good filter. You know, I like to say that if you're crystal clear on what you're looking for, then the strategies and the tactics to achieve that objective are going to make themselves apparent to you. And it's a great opportunity to just look for ways to find value, and the universe just gives back to you.
All right, let's talk about today's a great buying opportunity. There's tons of value investors out there taking advantage of today's market. Can you tell us what you're doing to make money in today's distressed real estate market?
Yeah, a lot of people recognize that there is it's the time to buy. You know, in the summertime you buy summer fruits and vegetables, and in the wintertime you don't because their price is twice as much. And that's kind of where we're at now. You know, it's the time to buy. Everything is, I don't want to say everything, but in many markets, we've hit bottom, and the cash flow numbers are great. So even if the value goes down, the cash flow is still phenomenal, and it's a great time to get in. So I'm looking for things that are duplicatable. You know, my business is large enough that I can't go find one house that's distressed and fix it up and then reap the profit, because it's too time intensive. You know, a lot of people, when they're starting out, that can make sense for them. But I really try to coach my investors that there's a difference between a real estate investment and a real estate business. And a real estate investment is an investment of capital, and a real estate business is an investment of capital and time and skills and relationships and so much more. And so for me, I've got both. I have investments in real estate, and I have a business in real estate. And for my investments, you know, I'm really looking for things that are, you know, triple net leased properties. I like retail, I like office, and I like industrial property that are just producing steady cash flow, especially businesses that are very core to basic commodities, things that are serving a lower income demographic. Those are businesses that I like. You know, just for simplicity, I would much rather own a Family Dollar store than a Tiffany's jewelry store, just because I see that in this economy, there's a lot of money moving closer to the bottom of the economic barrel, and I want to be there to rent to those tenants that are going to benefit from that shift. And single-family homes. I really like owning single-family homes, and many times, you know, better than apartments. And the reason is, for a single-family home, you've got multiple exit buyers and multiple exit strategies, and they're bite-sized. So when I go to resell a property, I could resell them in little tiny chunks rather than having to sell an entire apartment building. And then in terms of my real estate business, we build single-family homes. You know, I own a home building company in Dallas, Texas, and we're building single-family homes specifically for real estate investors. And the idea is, if you could buy a brand new home with a warranty and an investor support team around you that is giving you good mentorship and good support and training on how to be a good landlord, and a property management team and an asset protection team and estate planning team and everything that you need as an investor to be successful, that's what our home building company is trying to serve. And we also have some special financing to help investors get some positive cash flow but highly leveraged single-family homes. You know, because when I was starting out as a band director, you know, my biggest obstacle was, where do you get the money for down payments? And once you put all of your life savings into one house, then what? You know, it could take you, you know, if you're saving $1,000 a month, you know, you need $30,000 for a down payment, you got to wait 30 months to get another house, and the market cycle is going to be over. So, you know, if you're in that situation, how do you take advantage of today's buying opportunity while, you know, with working with limited cash resources. And because of that, I've created a special financing program where to help investors get, you know, up to 95% financing on their properties, so they can really get a much bigger portfolio and ultimately better cash flow because of that leverage.
Now, when you kind of got rolling, you were buying houses and more houses, and then you eventually started parlaying that into apartment buildings. Is that right?
Yeah, so I grew up in Southern California, and so my first investments were there, and then that market started getting a little overheated, so I sold that portfolio and moved the money up to some Central California markets, and that market started to get overheated, so I just liquidated those properties and rolled it into a single 30-unit apartment building in Vallejo, California. And it was a really unique deal because I bought it as apartments and I converted it to condominiums. I just did a change of use and then was able to sell off each unit individually. And the concept is, you know, you buy a dozen eggs for, let's say, $2, and then you go out and you sell each egg for 25 cents, and the net result is $3 of income and $2 of expense, so you made a dollar profit. And the kind of the great thing about that is everyone, you know, got value. The person who only needed one egg, you know, was able to bite off whatever they could afford and need. And so in my case, I was able to buy in bulk, which is a 30-unit apartment building, and then resell off each unit individually and make a profit. And doing that project was great because that gave me the seed capital I needed to launch my home building company.
Well, as you're out looking for deals, opportunistic and value-add deals in the distressed marketplace, what types of deals are you looking for?
Yeah, me personally, I am really, because my business is home building, that's my primary business, I am looking for sellers of land that are going to give me great terms, because I'm a huge believer of the concept that terms are more important than price. And yeah, I've heard the story told many, many times. You know, you name the price, and I'll name the terms. And so I'll pay you, you know, $1 billion for your little duplex there, and I'll put a dollar down and a dollar a month for the next billion months. And so those kind of terms make everything work out in your favor, you know, irrespective of price. So what I'm seeing in the marketplace is a lot of landowners where they're stuck on price, and my thing is terms. So I'll say, I'll give you your price on your dirt, but what I want you to do is, you know, number one, subordinate your equity to my construction loan. Number two, give me a long takedown schedule on your lots. You know, if you've got 100 lots, instead of me buying 100 of them and paying interest and taxes and mowing and all of that, you know, while I'm ready to use them, you know, go to the seller and say, I'd like you to give me, you know, 3 lots a month, or maybe 2 lots a month for the next however many months it takes. And that's a great way that I can use basically the seller's money and the seller's balance sheet to finance the construction. Because for example, if the land represents 20% of the equity in the project, I can get a bank to give me 80% of the construction costs, and then really I have no money into the development process. And, you know, except for earnest money and, you know, overhead and the actual running of a development company, that takes money. But in terms of the specific project, that's a great way, you know, a great deal structure to put together. And the other thing I'm looking for is opportunities to trade equity. You know, find someone that has a property with equity in it, and I can trade it for a different property type that makes sense for me and solves their problem. Or finding ways to solve a seller's challenge by creativity. You know, I recently acquired a large commercial property in Dallas, and we're working, it was a former retail center, and we're working on changing use from retail into vehicle storage and vehicle service center. And it's a, you know, that's a very recession-friendly type of business. Everybody's still driving, so they need a place to get their vehicles worked on. And, you know, I realized that retail was never coming back in this location, but a change of use was a great way for me to get income from the property that the seller hadn't thought of. And so I was able to buy a property at an extremely great price and change the use of it and make a profit.
Well, I love the creativity on that deal. That is awesome. especially with a lot of big boxes sitting out there vacant. This is a great opportunity to really get a discount in the price and put a spin on it and change the use and make some money.
Yeah. I'm actually really looking forward to, people are afraid of big boxes now because they don't know what to do with it. And if you can get the building cheap enough, then it really opens up so many different uses. You know, if you were paying, you know, let's say in a retail space, you might have spent $100 or $120 a square foot to buy it as a retail center. But the retail's dead and gone, and the building is vacant, and maybe if you could buy it for $10 or $20 a foot, way, way, way below replacement cost. But now when your basis is, you know, $20 a foot, there's all kinds of uses that make sense there that didn't make sense before when it was $100 a foot.
Gosh, you know, I look around this country, and I see all these vacant, boarded-up former auto dealerships that are just sitting there, and I look, there's got to be some great uses for that. Have you ever looked into that?
Yeah, and in fact, I'm actually partly contributing to that problem. I'm actually trying to aggregate a bunch of small auto dealerships into a single location, and because a lot of dealers have gotten smaller, they need less floor space, and they want to find ways to trim their overhead. And so by creating an auto center of multiple dealers, you know, former Toyota dealership, let's say, maybe you can get 7 or 8 or 10 used car dealers into that same space and then have, you know, shared overhead for office and financing and your title processing and things like that. So that could be, you know, one potential use. The other is, when you've got lots and lots of land, you know, you could either just look at, you know, doing a demo project and starting over. I'm working on a project now where it's something similar, you know, to an auto dealership with good freeway frontage, and we're working on making it into a truck stop. So, you know, you can get your, where the former sales room was, you know, put your showers and your restaurants and things like that. And then all of the places where the cars used to park is a great place for the trucks to go.
Well, that sure makes sense. Any environmental issues you think on something like that?
Yeah, you're starting with a vehicle use and you're converting it to a vehicle use. So, you know, that's a site-specific question, but I don't think it would be too hard. And the other thing is I've had great success starting with the property that I owned or wanted to acquire and setting up a meeting with either planning department or city council or the city manager, someone like that, or head of economic development or chamber of commerce, those type of people at the city. And you say, you know, I'm the owner of the property at, you know, Main and Main, and I'm having trouble with my property, and what would you recommend? What would you like to see me do with the property? If you own this property, what would you do with it? And it's amazing the uses that come out, because oftentimes the city will have a tenant that approaches them that says, hey, I'm a manufacturing person, and I'm looking for, you know, I'm working on a deal right now where I brought my property to the city and I wanted use, you know, a particular use. And the city said, well, that's interesting, but, you know, we're right now courting an industrial tenant, a manufacturing tenant, that would really like to have a site similar to yours. Let's make an introduction. And that's great. You know, I never would have had that that connection or thought to convert, in this case, it was a retail property into an industrial property. But with the city's introduction, you know, that was a good indication to me that I would get my change of use permit. Maybe, in this case, I did not need a zoning change, but perhaps, you know, if I did, you know, having the city initiate the project is sure helpful, because then you can say, hey, this was your idea to start with. Give me some support.
Yeah, that was a great tip. That was a golden tip right there, David. I hope our listeners pay attention to that, because that's really a unique way of trying to solve problems right there.
Yeah. You know, I'm also working on an interesting project where it's some city-owned land, and, you know, I really didn't know who owned this land. I just thought it was a really great parcel, and I looked it up on the tax records, and lo and behold, it's owned by the city, and be able to bring just studying what the city's mission statement was, I was able to kind of get a good feeling for what things they're proud of. And then went to that city and said, you know, what would you like to do with this land? And they said, we have no idea. And I said, well, you know, reading the mission statement of the city, I think this could be a good use. You know, I proposed something, you know, that was ecological and green and helpful to the community. And, you know, that's a project in process, but that's a great way to get into a project. And in this case, I am asking the city to give me great terms on their land, maybe give me some special financing, some bond financing. And, I mean, you never know what you can get if you're putting your brain and your team and your intellectual resources behind something. One of my mentors very early on said, never let the lack of capital stop you. Because if your deal is good enough, your idea is good enough, your team is good enough, the money will find you. And that was a really freeing thought, you know. And in this particular case, the gentleman said, David, if you can't fund your deal yourself and it's good, you come to me and I'll fund it. And that was so liberating.
Right.
That was so liberating for me that I just stopped worrying about the money and I just started worrying about, does it make economic sense? And if it does, someone will write the check.
Yeah, finding great deals. I think a lot of new investors are scared about finding money, but it really comes down to the deal. You're out and about with lots of stuff going on. You raise money from investors to fund a lot of your deals. What gets investors excited about investing in your deals?
Yeah, that is such a good question. And it is very unique to the investor. I really work with an investor to help them understand their personal investment philosophy. And for every investor, it's different. And getting them through be able to articulate and write down their personal investment philosophy can sometimes take hours or even days of, you know, coaching and really kind of digging into what their situation is like. And once their personal investment philosophy is articulated, then we find a deal structure to make that a win for them. And very oftentimes people focus on the product type or the real estate type first, when really they should be focusing on the deal structure. And let me give you an example. You know, so for me, the real estate is a widget. The real estate isn't really that important. It's just the thing that, you know, you're able to conduct commerce with. And let me give you an example. So if your primary motivation as an investor is security, well, then you probably don't want to be the owner of the property. Why don't we make you a first lien holder on the property? And then we'll have someone else's equity subordinate to yours so that if you don't get paid, then you're buying the property for 50 or 60 cents on the dollar. So you get a very secure position. You know, if your primary motivation is you don't have a lot of cash, your primary resource is the ability to get financing, then you probably want to go out and buy a single-family home because you can get 80% bank financing. Maybe a seller will give you some secondary financing on top of that, and you can get some high leverage. Maybe you can do a note of secured assumption. So you go, you know, assume someone else's mortgage. There really is no such thing as assumable mortgages now, but people still do it anyway with, you know, a wrapped note where you just take title and wrap the seller's old mortgage and just hope that the former lender doesn't care or find out. So that's still possible. But each of those strategies is independent of what the real estate is. You know, it's working with what their existing resources are, what their end result is, and when you need the money. You know, if you need the money tomorrow, probably don't go buy a single-family house because the time from cash to asset to cash is too long. You know, you're looking at, you know, 5 or 10 years if it's a hold. But if it's a flip, you know, then maybe that's, if you need your money really quickly, then maybe you'll flip houses. So that's really where I'm at is how do you, when I'm raising money for a deal, that was the root question. It's finding what is the investor's hot button and putting their money in a position to get achieving that result. So if someone is looking for a low yield, then let's go look at a triple net leased commercial property like a Dollar Tree or a Dollar General or something like that, and let's make you a first lien holder. You know, if you're looking for a higher yield, well, maybe you'll be the equity in the deal. And if you're looking for really, really high yields, well, let's go do, you know, something that's a change of use, or let's go buy a vacant building that's distressed where, you know, maybe we can hit 40 or 50% yields, but the downside is you might lose it all because you're buying a vacant building with some debt on it, and you know there's risk. So I think the best way for me to raise money is to just get in front of a lot of people and then ask them questions to say, what are you trying to achieve and what's your personal investment philosophy?
Well, I know cash flow is important to investors, especially today, and you've written a couple books on hassle-free cash flow investing and lending. Can you tell us about these books?
Yeah, so I've written two e-books that you can download for free on my website at hasslefreecashflowinvesting.com. And the first is on hassle-free cash flow investing, and the idea is the average person in America has a job, and they have a little bit of savings, and they're trying to figure out how do they create some type of financial independence, or they distrust the stock market, and they want to get their IRA type of money into a real estate, and they don't really know how. And so the idea behind hassle-free cash flow investing, it's not for the real estate professional who's trying to learn how to become a full-time real estate investor. It's for the school teacher or the doctor, lawyer, engineer, accountant that is making good money. They're happy working their job in the short term, or at least that's their economic highest and best use of their time at this moment, is to keep working their job. And then how do they make money, working very part-time with a minimum amount of hassle through leveraging the capital they have, their ability to borrow, and their strategic relationships. That's the idea, is making money through real estate very simply with a minimum investment of time. Hassle-free cash flow lending is the same concept, but it's how to be a private lender. And it's written with the idea that there's just enough technical information for you to say, wow, I learned a lot, and I now don't know quite enough how to remove my own appendix, so I need some help. And that's by design, because being a private lender is very, very complicated. And if it's done correctly, it's very safe. And if done incorrectly, you could take huge unnecessary risks as a private lender. And the idea behind the book is to give the person who is really intrigued by the idea of being a private lender earning 8 to 12% on their money, being very passive, to give them some basic vocabulary and some basic ideas and a rudimentary understanding of how being a private lender works, so that when they work with a broker like myself, that they can feel comfortable that they understand the terminology and vocabulary of being a private lender.
Hey, David, when I think of David Campbell, I think of creative, I think of strategic, and I know you've been quoted as saying, properties do not have problems, people do. Can you explain your philosophy and kind of tell how investors, how they can capitalize on that?
So it goes back to understanding that the way to create value is solving problems. And every property is an opportunity. Sometimes it's an opportunity for the buyer. Sometimes it's an opportunity for the seller. And really, if you ask great questions and you listen, sometimes you'll find a way to create unique deal structures. And so, for example, every time someone is offering a property for sale, 100% of the time, that person has a need. And sometimes their need is to sell the property, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes what they're really trying to solve is a need for cash. Sometimes they're trying to just solve a management hassle. Sometimes it's an inheritance issue where they inherited a property and they just don't have the resources or inclination to continue managing it. Sometimes their debt has expired. They have a balloon payment due and they can't make it. Right now I'm representing a buyer on a portfolio of about 1,000 apartments in Dallas. And it's a situation where the seller is not distressed, but they had a five-year loan with a balloon in 5 years, and that was 7 years ago. So now their loan is 2 years past due, and their bank is in getting impatient, saying, even though we're getting our money every month, your loan is past due, and we're getting ready to foreclose for non-payment of the balloon. So now that's a highly motivated seller, And their problem isn't the property. Their problem is the debt. And if you didn't know that, you might, you know, be thinking, well, what's the problem with the property? It's actually a problem with the seller and their relationship to the debt. And maybe if you could bring in a good signature, you know, maybe if you've got a great guarantor in your pocket, you could go to the seller and say, let's create a joint venture. I'll refinance the property for you in exchange for a large percentage of the ownership, and we'll leave your equity in. You know, you don't have to get your equity out because your problem wasn't needing your equity. Your problem was you just didn't want to lose it all in foreclosure because you couldn't refinance.
What other types of creative deal structures are you working on today? I mean, I know that's kind of your expertise. Can you share a few?
So really, it's very deal-specific and person-specific when the creativity process starts. And the general idea behind creativity is just customization, not approaching a deal that one size fits all. For example, a lot of my buyers of single-family houses need additional leverage, and so they can buy a single-family house from me, and at some point in their ownership process, I can put a second mortgage on the property for them, you know, a private second mortgage. Not at the point of purchase, but as a refinance after they own it, then I can help them pull equity out of their property. And, you know, then as a real estate investor, I've got a portfolio of notes. And notes are good because they generate interest, and I like interest, but what I really like is owning property. So I'm putting a deal together where I'm trading a portfolio of notes that I created in exchange for the down payment on a medical office building. And it's a situation where the seller really would like all cash, but there's no buyers in the marketplace for his property as all cash. So I can come to the table with a 75% bank loan and 25% cash down payment with the requirement that he then use his cash down payment after close to purchase my notes. So basically we can do a double escrow. I can sell him my note portfolio, he can sell me his property, and since it's an exchange where we're exchanging equity for equity, and it's a way for me to get out of a note without discounting it. You know, most people would say, hey, you got a note and you want to get the cash, well, go sell your note at a discount and then, you know, get your cash and then go to the seller and give them your cash. And that kind of goes back to your last question of properties don't have problems, people do, and how do you solve the people problems? And it's by moving the equity from one side of the table to the other side of the table. And it's really common sense. The place that a lot of people get in trouble is how do you stay compliant with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and RESPA, so that, you know, everything is above board. And that's why it's good to have, you know, in-house legal counsel and good you know, licensed brokers and people working with you to help you put your deals together, especially when you start getting creative and there's financing involved. But there's a lot of opportunities to take a party with equity and, you know, for example, land. You know, oftentimes a land seller, in this market, there's no buyer. So I'm working on a project where the person who has some land next to me, he owns it free and clear, and I need a little bit more financing for my property that I'm working on. I need a little bit more capital for the deal. So I went to the person who has the adjacent land to my mine, and I said, why don't we get a first mortgage on your land, and you could use that cash out refinance proceeds to buy equity in my property, and then we'll use your refinance proceeds to do tenant improvements because I have a tenant ready to go, and we'll use the cash flow from this tenant to pay the mortgage on my property and the mortgage on your land. And now you've turned what was a negative cash flow property, because even free and clear land is negative cash flow with insurance and taxes, and I was able to take his negative cash flow land into positive cash flow land by using the equity in his land to freeing that equity in his land into cash to use tenant improvements for my property to get a tenant for both of us.
Well, a lot of these creative financing approaches you're talking about, exchanging and trading real estate equities, it seems complicated. You seem like a pretty sharp guy. How does the average real estate investor approach this? I mean, is it a lot easier than it sounds?
Yeah. Very simply, you know, having a good team around you. So if someone out there has a property that they're trying to figure out a use for or putting a trade together and they don't know how to do it and they want a support team to help them put it together, you could send me an email at David, D-A-V-I-D, at tradeup.net, tradeup.net, David at tradeup.net, and I'm happy to look at your deal and see if there's a way I can help you structure it and put it together in a creative but also legally compliant way. And short of that, really, I'm not aware of anybody who's teaching creative real estate in a useful way. You know, I really see it's a hands-on process. Get out there in the marketplace. Just sky's the limit. And really, one of the ways that I've been able to be creative is I didn't start out with a traditional real estate background. A lot of people go to school and study real estate and study finance in a very textbook way, and I didn't. You know, I studied music in college and
learned. Teacher.
Yeah, and that was a very creative process too. You know, how do you
it is.
Work with 150 teenagers and get them to do what you want them to do at this time that you want them to do it, and kind of bootstrap your way through fundraising programs for your band program and whatnot.
A little side note: what instruments do you like to play, or do you play any instruments?
Yeah, I do. I play the trumpet, and I used to play trumpet in one of the bands at Disneyland. And I did a little bit of recording as a trumpet player, and I played in the Orange County Symphony. And I really enjoy playing the trumpet. I also play drums and piano, and it's a great hobby. You know, what's really neat, once a year I play in a band on a cruise ship full of real estate investors. You know, once a year we go out on a cruise, and last year there was over 100 people on the cruise, and this year Robert Kiyosaki is coming along with us for a week, and Wayne Palmer and Ken McElroy, who are Rich Dad advisors. And on the cruise, we get to play music, and it's amazing. You look at a group of 100 or 200 real estate investors, and there's always at least a dozen people who are good musicians. And you know, we get together and make a band and have a great time. And one of the neat things I've found is, I would say the majority of the people I do business with in real estate have some type of a musical talent or musical skill. And you know, so if your kids are young and you want to be real estate entrepreneurs, I think the best thing to do is put them in the band.
Well, Dave, a few more questions before we wrap up here. what big mistakes are investors making when they're trying to put together deals or trying to structure them?
I think the first thing is not understanding the life cycle of cash and saying, well, I'm going to put my cash into a deal without thinking about when they're going to get that money back and how they're going to get it back. I'm a huge believer in knowing when and how you're going to sell the property before you buy it, or making the assumption that you're going to buy it forever and you're leaving it to your heirs. So rule number one, have an exit strategy before you buy. And the exit strategy isn't oftentimes for the property. It could just be for your equity. You know, that's what I like to teach is you buy the property, get your equity back out, and keep the property. And so I really am a big believer of that. So if people are having a different strategy on real estate investing, I'm always curious to look at what their cash on cash return is when they leave their money in, you know, long term. You say, well, it's nice that you got a bunch of free and clear property, but what is your cash on cash return compared to, say, let's say we pulled out 50% of that equity conservatively and we doubled the size of your portfolio. You know, then what would happen to your cash on cash return? The second thing that is a huge mistake investors are making is not having a support team around them. I see people oftentimes, they try to go it alone in a marketplace, or they assume that a group of professionals is too busy to take their phone call, and they just kind of muck it on their own. Or they try to just go around people or be secretive with their team. It's very much like going to your doctor and, you know, just saying, well, I'd like some penicillin. And the doctor says, well, what's wrong with you? And they say, well, I just want some penicillin. Give me some penicillin. It's none of your business why I want penicillin. Just give it to me. And I see investors make that kind of mistake in the marketplace where they're afraid to open up about what their personal investment philosophy is, what they're really trying to buy. People don't like to be sold, but people love to buy. And I really encourage people to get a team around them and then to say, my personal investment philosophy is, and then they can be very articulate about what it is. And there's an infinite number of properties in the world, you know, virtually, and there's no way you could look at all of them. So you have to have search criteria. So when you go on the MLS and there's, you know, 6 million properties in America for sale, how do you narrow that down to the one you're going to buy? And it's simply by having good filters and making sure that your filters are consistent with your long-term vision. Thirdly, I think, is insufficient cash reserves. Oftentimes, someone has, you know, $30,000, and they say, well, all I need to buy this property is $30,000, and they put it all in. And then the first cash call comes because they're vacant or there's a repair, and then they lose control over the property. And so I would much rather have, if I could choose between putting 20% down and having no money in the bank or putting 5% down and having 15% in the bank, I would much rather have the higher leverage and the greater cash reserves.
I hope you enjoyed this interview. For more information on David Campbell, please visit his website at www.hasslefreecashflowinvesting.com or email him at david@hasslefreecashflowinvesting.com. For any other questions, comments, or ideas, please email me at craig@valuehoundacademy.com.